Yeah, but it's not this particular role.
Yeah.
So.
New moon during Reba.
Thank you. Thank you.
guidance to accept you?
No, I did. I don't know what happened because I was really in 7-10.
I think that's before you accept me. I'm not sure I appreciate that before you. I need to run and find the building, I might forget. Could you have the time 10? I can go back and tell it to you. Okay, so star will send you. Star. 001. Hash. Yeah. Yeah, I think that'll make me for that point.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. minister. I'm not too sure. I feel I'm really wrong. So what if I just imagine this is the last year I'm going to see on this guy? Is that just too much?
Who is that?
I'm not sure, but I've got a gentleman Jefferson to give me an opportunity. I know they made a record for this.
I don't know.
But this is the one on trade and industry.
Yeah, just one more.
No, the ordinary one, the shop, and just call them.
I'm sorry. Can you come
here
and see?
Yes, I am.
What the guy is that?
Yeah. So we are going to be and thank you for those who came in early as well. And on time, all of those who came to Parkland. Thank you very much to the staff Starkham, the Industrial Development Division. We also wish to welcome Mr. Shinde. Is that right, Shinde? Yes. And then Dr. Makuba, Chief Director, Industrial Procurement. It was great to be able to greet Dr. Makuba again. We've known each other for what, nearly 3 years or so. And great to see you again. I didn't know you were with DTI. And then we'll welcome Stabs. I think you'll be doing this together, will you? In terms of our agenda, you'll be dealing with the Bureau of Standards, Localization and Public Procurement all at the same time. So thank you very much to Dr. Mekulu Makula, Chief Executive Officer Stabs, Mr. McCarmel, Executive Certification Stabs, and Ms. B. Masako, Chief Financial Officer. And I understand, there are two people away who we did invite, but I think we could still go ahead on this. He's not here this morning. I don't know if it's DTI or who, but is everyone here? Then? Okay, that's fine. You do have some apologies. Mr. MacPherson, Honourable MacPherson, Party Business. And Honourable Mankash is attending the Portfolio Committee on Labour. Honourable Williams, who took ill yesterday and is really not well again this morning, and we do hope because he's not one of those that enjoys staying in bed, and we wish him a speedy recovery back to normal. Those are the three apologies that I have. I'm looking around me, there aren't any others, and I'm saying this.
I will just talk out the science and technology around about but come back.
Now, we just want to make it clear, and we did say this at the beginning of the term, we do require written apologies, either by email or by full letter, either from yourself directly or your secretary and other admin in the party. So please do ensure that because, I'm obliged to mark you absent if we haven't got such a written thing. And we stretched half past 9 to 10. It is going to be half past 9. So please make sure you've all done that in future. Before you adopt the agenda, I just need formally to process the adoption of the work plan of the subcommittee on gambling. So before we do that, can we add that in immediately after the adoption of the agenda? So can we have someone to propose the adoption of the agenda? Thank you, Honourable Kornoff, seconded by... Oh, well, if you don't want your plan, you're seconded by the Honourable, yes, the Hogan. You know, the people on the subcommittee can't very well adopt it back again in the committee. So you're going to move ahead, but on the proviso, which I raised yesterday, that you do have the policy in front of you. You've had a draft for some time. We will be briefed as a committee on the 8th, on the 9th, you'll go back to it again, but we're no longer going to delay the bill itself, the remote private member's bill proposed by promoting by the Honourable Hill Lewis, and we're bringing that back the week after that. So I just want that clear. So watch the program. We're not going to finalise it before the recess, but we will deal with it immediately to come back again. So just so that everyone is on track with the new program. On that note now, please can we hand it over to yourself? Yes, I thought we had. Yes. That's the agenda. Yes, Honourable Cox.
No, thank you very much, President. Just clarity. We were dealing with the draft, please. would you have the one that has passed through Karnak? Whether we'll get copies before the briefing today or cannot see your question.
You'll find from our own start it's not dramatically different, but nevertheless look from the actual one. I'm told by the secretary here that I didn't actually get this work plan adopted. I thought we had. I thought we had just adopted it. Alright, can we now propose for this work plan? Someone should propose a work plan to be adopted. It'll have to be more or less the same two people, because the other two are members of the subcommittee. Yes, thank you, Honourable Cronel. Seconded, can we have you to second that, Honourable Esther Newsom? The work plan, thank you. Good thing you're here. And you've all got it. So let's immediately then go across to yourself then, Mr. Strachan, to take us through. Is that the way you like it? Or wouldn't it be better if we had the CEO coming in first? Or did you want to press us something? I don't know, because sometimes DDI prefers to do a little intro and then we hand it over to the entity. How do you want to do it this morning?
As a chair of the committee, it might be more useful perhaps for the DDI to present an overall context and framework. But, yeah.
Great. So if you could go ahead then, thank you. Who's going to take us? Dr. Makube. Thank you.
Chairperson, and good morning, members. The presentation will cover the background on the PPPA, in particular Regulation 9.3. I will give an overview on the list of designated sectors, highlights on progress as well, and priority areas that we are working on in implementing the policy. As you know, that the new PPPA, or amended, let me say that, PPPA regulations came into being on the 7th of December 2011, and in there, what is important is Section 9 or Regulation 9 dealing with local production and content. The DCI derives powers to designate sectors for local production from Regulation 9.1, which in essence gives the Minister of Trade and Industry powers to designate product sectors and commodities for local production. So there is a definition of what we call local content, you know, because if you interact with various government departments and public entities as well as state-owned companies, they all talk about local procurement. But in our perspective as implementers of the PPPA regulations, we talk about local content, which in essence is about local manufacturing. You know, anything which is or product that is designated for local production must be manufactured within the borders of South Africa. So there is the research that we undertake before we designate a sector for local production. Obviously, we have to look at the manufacturing capacity available, skills, partnerships with local firms. We also have linkages with supplier development initiatives. So that's what we consider before we designate a sector for local production. So there is a designation process flow that we undertake. Firstly, we work with the industry doing sector research analysis. We are also bound by international law in making sure that we can only designate for the public sector in general, not the private sector. So we have to check whether government does buy the product. We look at the import export trend, if obviously the the trade balance is not positive. So those are the areas that we consider before we designate with the multiplier in terms of jobs. If though all those variables are positive, we do some consultation with the industry, and also there is a committee within the TI that will look at the business case for each and every product that is designated. Once we agree to designate, we work with the National Treasury as the custodian of supply chain policy within government. And if we agree, we send the submission to our minister and then forward the proposal to the National Treasury so that instruction can be issued to all procurement entities within the state. Now, in our implementation of local content, there are areas that we are beginning to learn. Obviously, the focus by state or government procurement entities is on the delivery of the final product. All right. And for us, we are focusing on the value chain. Right. It's not only on the delivery of the final product. So we do realize that there are areas in the value chain that have an impact on local content. So it doesn't start on the delivery of the product. The areas, like if you look at the Hollands, the design does have an impact on local procurement. So we know that in certain instances, international standards have been used, you know, to that a particular product must be manufactured according to an international standard. Certain instances, we find that local manufacturers do not have that capability to manufacture according to that standard. So as a result, we get requested as a DTI to issue exemptions, you know, because no one can manufacture. Now, we do consider issues of security of supply, service delivery. In certain instances, we do consider those exemptions if we do not have the capability to manufacture. So those areas are important, you know, to consider, and we are beginning to learn. And in certain instances, we do refuse to issue an exemption if we do have standards in the country to manufacture. We do engage with procurement entities that please review a particular standard and issue the specification according to the standards that we have. If you look at the role there, those are other objectives that the government is considering. I mean, issues of PE, issues of industrial finance, they do have an impact on local procurement. So as we are implementing, you know, sometimes we have to deal with trade-offs embedded in those areas outlined in under the scope there. Now, the slide that is currently there shows the green path shows the products or commodities that have been designated so far. So we have about 15 of them with different thresholds. So where we have threshold is 100%, it means that we do not allow imports into the country. So the textile, others, we find that we even designate a certain component. So it's the product itself of components. So certain instances, we find that the component might vary from 10 to 100%. So where there is 100%, we do not allow the importation of products or materials. Less than 100% means that there are certain materials, components, which South Africa does not manufacture. So we do allow the importation of those components so that local manufacturing can take place in the country. So we do not allow the importation of a fully functional product. We allow for the importation of material and components so that local manufacturing can happen. On the red one, those are the records of commodities that we have forwarded to the National Treasury for consideration. So we have approved them for determination within the DTI. So as I've highlighted before, it's a process. The Minister of Trade and Industry then, of Finance, sorry, must then issue the infraction notes. So those are being considered by the National Treasury. And I think the last point there deals with the guidelines for implementation of online monitoring of the PPA. That deals with the local procurement of non-designated products, which I will cover later. Now there is a process to be followed by procuring entities. Firstly, when a product has been designated for local production, it is a requirement by procuring entities that when they advertise, they must advertise tenders with conditions for local production. So in certain instances, when we talk about compliance, because I mean, there's been in the media, I mean, there's a talk about non-compliance, but it's a process. Firstly, when it comes to advertisement of tenders, procuring entities must advertise to the conditions for local procurement. So if that does not happen, that's the third level of non-compliance. In certain instances, we do intervene as a DTI, ask the procuring entities to retract those tenders and amend. So in the past year, we have, I think, more than 150 tenders where instances where tenders were advertised without that condition. So we do intervene. Also, there is a condition that if a particular raw material cannot be sourced in the country, BIAS must approach the DTI for an admission. That must happen before the closure of the tender. We don't issue a letter of admission once the tender is closed. So that is the requirement. And the last point there is very clear that the code of the authorization letter, that the admission letter, must be attached to the bidding document. So that when procuring entities do the evaluation, they will be able to see that if a bidder doesn't meet the required threshold, then there is a reporting letter from the DTI saying that yes, the reason why they are not meeting the threshold is because we have given them a letter of exemption to import a particular material. And another requirement also is that once bids are awarded, you know, the procuring entities must submit to the DTI standard bidding documents as well as annexures, which are signed by bidders, you know, so that then we can be able to see the declaration by them in terms of local content threshold. And I think in the slide by the Bureau of Standards, you see the number of, even in blue terms, the tenders that have been awarded. So those numbers are derived from the declaration document that has been submitted from the DTI. So as the DTI, we do our analysis and then submit those bidding documents together with the annexures to the South African Bureau of Standards for verification. Now, Regulation 9.3 deals with local procurement of non-designated products. So we do remember that in terms of 9.1, it is only the Minister of Trade and Industry that can designate. But government has said that we must support local procurement. So 9.3 is an opportunity by procuring entities to support local procurement of non-designated products. Now we have issued a guideline which is still being considered by the National Treasury. We have worked with other government entities in invoking this 9.3 in the procurement of non-designated sectors. It is important, the regulation is clear that procuring entities can only invoke this regulation once they have notified the National Treasury and the DTI. But it's important that we follow the legal prescript. As I said before, there are many definitions of what is local procurement. You know, so for us, it must be within the borders of South Africa, not within the borders of municipality or a province. So we need to consider the constitutional imperatives and legal imperatives. We also need to consider the economic factors as well as the fiscal risks. So that is why we engage the National Treasurer on those areas. But it is an important regulation to support local production as well as the promotion of SMEs in the country. Now, in terms of progress, what has happened thus far, and I think you'll be able to see the value of the tenders on the numbers that will be presented by the SAPS. We know that in the rail fleet, which is the biggest of the designated sectors, Prasa and Kibela Rail, they've started issued a tender to Kibela Consortium for the acquisition of more than 7,200 coaches. We know that there is a plant that is going to be built in Tanota and Eburuleni, where it is estimated that around 8,000 jobs will be created. Transnet also is awarded a tender of 50 billion rand, and you'll be able to see those numbers. The tender has been awarded to China South Rail, China North Rail, Boradia, and General Electric, where about more than 1,000 electric and physical locomotives are going to be built in South Africa, especially in Pretoria and then. Now, as I said, that the focus is not on the acquisition of a fully functional product. For us, it's opening up opportunities in the value chain. You know, so we are linking SMEs to the OEMs, you know, the original equipment manufacturers. So we have an option to fully import fully functional locomotives into the country. That's one option that we have. But we will be losing in terms of positive externalities. So by manufacturing those locomotives and coaches in the country, we are able to open up opportunities in the value chain by SMEs to supply components, to supply materials. And not only, I mean, there are also other indirect multipliers down the value chain. So the focus is on the value chain for us and not on the final product. Same on the autos. We know that in the past we used to import the buses for the PRT program. Now we are manufacturing the bus bodies in South Africa. Marco Polo is having a plant in Chimiste, and some of the buses that have been supplied to the City of Transpec and Swanee were manufactured in the plant in Transpec. We know also that in this city as well, some of the buses were procured from Volvo. South Africa, Swane has also awarded the tender to MAN to supply 120 city buses. Pharmaceutical products have been designated as well. So, I mean, in the sector, because of security of supply issues, we have agreed that we will consider designation per tender, you know. What has happened is that the ARVs have been designated for local production, and we know that certain instances 70% of the volumes have been given to South African companies which are listed there. The other tender, which is the oral solid dosage, the OSD tender, has been also been awarded to about 38 companies in South Africa, and this has assisted, amongst other things, in lowering the cost of supplying the pharmaceutical product. And we know that we were one of the leading countries in terms of supplying the ARVs. So there is not only a direct positive improvement in terms of manufacturing, but also in terms of the health benefits, given that South Africa is a country with a high burden of disease. So those are the benefits that we derive by promoting local manufacturers. Now, priority areas for consideration in moving forward is that we we are working on aligning professionals and believers to optimize industrial development. I mean, this government has come up with a target of 75% local procurement. So we are working on instruments to achieve that. I mean, our mandate is more, is derived from regulation 9 of the PFA. We do designate that it's an instrument for local procurement. We also have 9.3. So we are working with the National Treasury in developing guidelines, because the regulation, the PFA is saying that the National Treasury must come up with directives for to implement regulation 9.3. So the TCI, we have taken an initiative and developed a draft guidance which is being considered by the National Treasury. We are also, there is an agreement that we will review all the instructions that has a fee in it. So in the past, we decided to deem the importation of steel as being local because of the import parity prices that were applied in the South African economy. We all know now that the steel industry basically has collapsed over, and there are challenges. So as part of supporting local procurement of primary steel, we have agreed with the National Treasury that we must remove the deeming of imported steel so that we support the local procurement of primary steel. The other area that we are dealing with is on the PFA reforms, especially the issue of non-compliance. As I said, that it is a process to deal with non-compliance. It's on the advertising up until the evaluation, and also in certain instances the false declaration by the bidder. So that is why we have the Bureau of Standards that must go to the factories and make sure that local production does take place. You know, because the system currently is a self-declaration, you know, and therefore we must do that. We are currently engaging also with the Auditor General's office on the auditing of expenditure on designated sectors. Currently, the AG's office is doing the sampling of tenders and then go to do that audit. So we have agreed that we need a new media rights process instead of sampling, because based on the sample, you can choose those that are compliant and leave the ones that are non-compliant. So we are working with the Auditor General, and the DGI is going to train the Auditor General on the implementation of local content. Also, there is work there on the PPE, in particular now that we have a program on the black industrialists, so there are linkages to the supply development program. Those are the areas that we are also working on. We are currently reviewing the technical specification on the measurement of local content. We have implemented it now since 2012. We know that there are some challenges, and that's the reason that we are reviewing it, so that we firm up those areas where we think there are leakages. We, as I said, that we do advance some products from local production based on requests, and all the instruction notes do indicate that if we can't be able to supply the product either the volume or based on the specifications from the procuring entity, we can exempt. So we are working with the CSIR as well as the Department of Science and Technology, the Technology Localization Unit. Once we have exempted those products, we do provide a list to them so that we can invest in those technologies, so that we improve or increase productivity in the country. The other area is capacity building on local content, because it's generally a new program in the country, and some supply chain practitioners are still finding it difficult. So we have the responsibility as a DTI to train them. So the focus moving forward it's more on local government, because that's where we are seeing that there is a challenge. So moving forward, we'll be providing training at that level. As I said before, we are working with DPE on localization, particularly on the rail fleet procurement. That's an area where we want to focus in the short to medium term, especially on supply development program. There is a scope for us to work with original equipment manufacturers in making sure that we don't only manufacture the fleet in the country, but to develop local suppliers so that they are also linked to the OEMs. So when OEMs get other tenders globally, that will be able to source some of the components in South Africa, and that is the benefit of local production. And lastly, it's on you know, linkages with other procurement levers, especially NIP, which is the National Industrial Participation Program. So currently what we are considering is that as we are giving an exemption or exemption to OEMs to source some of the components, so some might find that they might be more than the threshold as covered in NIP. So how can we use different procurement levers so that we don't just give an advantage, but we come up with offset projects and that we are able to benefit as a country. So yes, in the short to medium term, we will be working on securing or making sure that there are linkages in between procurement leaders. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Makube. Is there anyone else on DTI who wishes to add to that? Yes, DDG?
Let me just make one point. The issue of reciprocity is absolutely critical. We can't have a situation where we designate for local procurement and South African companies feel that it's an easy ride to government tenders. And so with respect to price, with respect to standards, on-time delivery, required specifications, and rating competitiveness, those reciprocal conditionalities are absolutely critical. So the best measure of competitiveness is, or perhaps the easiest, is whether a South African company can export into a global market. And so, to give you an example, General Electric identified 100 supplier companies from South Africa. Many of them couldn't meet the standards required of General Electric. But General Electric brought 6 engineers to assist the local supply companies to raise their capabilities to be able to supply on time to the right specification and at the right price. And then, as typical, Dr. Makube has said, working with us in the CSIR, the Technology Localization Unit assisted in raising the capabilities of those companies. So, for example, IEC Holden, which is a company in that supply chain, as an example, can now produce a drivetrain for a locomotive assembled in South Africa, and then the next step is to ensure that they build the capabilities to be able to get into the global value chains. And across sectors, this is absolutely critical. How we work with these global OEMs to build a local supply chain, raise the competitiveness of those supply chains, and get into global value chains for the export of the components into other markets. Thank you.
We're going to, Mendel just immediately go on with SAB. because there is a direct link to share. Yes, so do go ahead. Thank you.
Good morning, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members, officials from the Department of Trade and Industry. The SABS plays a small role in the chain of the local content policy. We play a role of verification, and that is an auditing function that comes in when all the instruments that Dr. Boko spoke about have been put in place. So our role is very specific. We are auditing and verifying that the information that companies have provided in the tender process, that information is correct. And that's the only role that we play in this engagement. Just to talk about the timelines, in 2011, the specification was published, and it's against that specification that we audit. In September 2012, we were appointed as the local content verification agency by the DCI, and in 2013, then established the office, we constituted the office. It's important that I emphasize that the establishment of the office was funded by the SABS. There hasn't been funding that has gone into the establishment of that office. So we've diverted our own funds to capacitate the office because we saw this as an opportunity to assist the country and the policy instrument, but also for the SABS to be relevant in the new policies of our government that are meant to stimulate the economy. And so we, with our board, agree that this is what an activity that SABS should invest in to ensure that we are able to have impact on the economy. In November 2014, we issued a first verification certificate, and in July 2015, we got the revised National Treasury instruction note that reaffirms the SABS role in the verification process. We understand the broad objectives of the local content within the triple PFA legislation as an enabling instrument that is supposed to support economic growth in job creation in the country, leveraging the public expenditure to ensure that the local manufacturing sector is stimulated and that new investment is attracted into the economy. And when the value chain is well managed, we are then able to compute that impact in the economy, and the verification process is meant to compute all of these objectives and be able to give our government the impact, quantitative results on the impact of the policy. So when all the good objectives that we put forward at the end of the day, after 10 years, when we are asked what has happened, you want to be able to use quantitative data to show how the policy has an impact. And the verification and the audit process that we do is meant to then verify these objectives. These are some of the designations and their thresholds that come from the designation process that Dr. Sebosu spoke about. The value chain and the low value chain, this is a complete value chain, and it's a DCI value chain. The SABS then plays a role on the section starting from problem 5. That's when the DCI then gives the documents to the SABS. And once we get it, the documents then start to scope the work as the SABS, and we engage with the procuring entity. And that's where we are then finding ourselves in a difficulty. Because when we then scope the work and we engage with the entity, either we don't get any responses from the entity, or the entity writes back and says, we thought the DCI was going to do this and pay for it. Please don't talk to us, talk to the DCI. We submitted our documents to the DCI, you know, who are you to be engaging with us? And in the space where there is clarity about enforcement, that has become a stumbling block, where was generated. We've expended resources as SAVS in the administration to engage with these companies and entities that are procuring, and you find that at the end of the day, there are less the second thoughts that are engaging with who's going to pay. And this policy comes from, you know, governments are paying. We were not told at the beginning when we started the procurement process, and work then ends up not being done. So just to give the quantitative data on some of the tenders. So the amount for just 1 year or half a year, they will amount to billions, and sometimes hundreds of billions. But you'll find that only one verification is done. And that's because as the SABM can't enforce. So we go back and we report to the DTI that the entity wants to know who's going to pay for the verification. And when we don't get past that, then the verification doesn't continue. The example that has been put forward by Dr. Teboko, the one on the first day, of the three cities, the major metros that have procured bus transit systems, only the city of Johannesburg did the verification. The others have started their processes, they've procured, and they have not done the verification process. So they can talk about local content, but we don't know if the local content is there. And that then becomes a problem because you do find that self-declaration is sometimes exaggerated so that people can be awarded the tender. And when they are awarded the tender on the basis of self-declaration and that is not verified, then we are encouraging more people to exaggerate their self-declaration because they know that no one is going to verify and they're not going to be found out. So those companies are continuing to enjoy the benefit of those tenders, and no one has gone to verify whether what they have declared as local content in their tenders is indeed the numbers. And that becomes a problem. It undermines the whole policy. It undermines the big investments that have gone into a government putting these instruments, designating the sectors, doing research to decide on the designation threshold, and the whole capacity that's been put together within DTI at the SABS as National Treasury to ensure that this policy instrument works. If we cannot verify, all of that is just a hypothesis. You cannot verify whether it's working or not.
Yeah, I just want to stop you right there because this is a very important aspect now. Just the committee, take us back a little bit in terms of verification. And now we know DTI's role, we have the designation. How do we link up then with the verification of procurement through Treasury and then it comes back to you for that final verification? Just give us a little picture about this clearly, because it's a very important aspect.
Honourable Chair, the procurement entity is supposed to, in their tender specification that goes out to the market, is supposed to be clear about the designation threshold as part of the specification. You will specify in your tender that maybe this product must be SABS approved, and you will specify that entities that have CEE level, and in that same tender document that goes up, a bidding document, you will then specify the threshold as the national the designated threshold. This is a designated sector, and the threshold for local content is this much. The entities are then required to self-declare. And they are always optimistic and they will declare because they want to be in, they want to be considered. So they're never going to declare below what is required. So if the threshold is 70, we find that most entities will say we are 90% local content, we are 90% local content. It's a self-declaration. The entity then evaluates the bidding and decides on the tender. what the entity is then supposed to do is to say, we are allowed to view this tender on the basis of your first declaration, but to confirm your award, we will then do the verification. And government has provided an instrument to do that verification. But that instrument is seen as voluntary. So entities choose to just continue and not use the instrument. So they award the tender and they continue doing the work, and no one says stop, who have not done the verification. And a lot of tenders that have been awarded, they continue, the work continues, the services get delivered without the verification happening. So the documents are then submitted to the DTI, and it's the DTI that gives us the documents. Where it becomes a problem is when we take over from the DTI and we then have to engage with the entity about who pays for the verification. And when we generate a cost, and the cost is based on the hours needed to go to the factory, to go to various levels of input into that final product. And when the entity engages with the cost, then they say, well, we did not budget for this amount, the DTI then pay for it. What should happen is that in the tender document, it must be clear that the winning bidder will pay, because it's not every entity that's bidding that is possibly not going to get the tender that should be incurring costs of verification. That will be burdensome to the company. But the company that wins the tender should pay for the verification. And the company will say, turn around and say, well, the procuring entity did not specify that in their bidding document. So I did not budget for it, I did not calculate in the cost, so somebody else must pay for it. And it's just that conundrum that needs to be resolved. I hope I've clarified that, you know, that process.
Some of us will be coming back on that, because I don't see the point in saying 70% localization. I mean, it's all haywire. There's no proof of anything. What is the point? Okay, this is gold, and well, that's sold as gold. No, I just actually think you've identified a huge flaw. But do carry on.
Thanks, Chris. So, as challenges, we've identified as the SADS, it's very less enforcement, and you know, that the first year and the second year, you are as an entity that obviously has a responsibility in terms of the TFMA to balance your costs and to manage your costs. You look at you know, you funded an opportunity and an infrastructure, and over time, if that infrastructure does not sustain itself, then you have to answer to your board about that expenditure. So and that's why we are now with the SAD talking about the maintenance of that office. We've resourced that office, we've put the infrastructure, we've put systems in place to be able to do local content verification. And we are unable to do the verification because there isn't enforcement. The policy itself and the instruments are finally removed at the cost. So when there's an engagement between National Treasury and the DTI and the companies and the procuring entities and the SADS, it just becomes a blaming game where there isn't clarity about who should bear the cost. And I think if there was that clarity, it would go a long way in assisting us to get on with the work. Sometimes the bidding entity themselves choose to omit requirements of local content, and when you engage with them post, it then becomes very difficult to implement local content verification, because when it's not a requirement up front, it will be unfair to the bidders to then put that requirement post. So the entity that's procuring is then supposed to take responsibility for that omission and pay for the verification. I must say that the biggest challenge has been the lack of buy-in from procuring entities. It moves from it's too expensive, you know, the FABF quotation is too high, to no, no, somebody else must pay. Because when you, when somebody says it's too high, you then say, okay, so how much should it be? It can't be for free, because there's an infrastructure, there are people employed, it's got socio-economic objectives that are of value to the country. What are we willing to pay for it? Let's have that region. And when people say zero, because we did not come up with this policy, then it becomes a difficult engagement. There's currently no instrument to deal with non-compliance, and we appreciate the efforts from the DCI to work with the Auditor General to try and bring the enforcement. But, you know, currently there isn't the enforcement. There are also misconceptions that this is the way to spy on the performing entities. We're going to use the information to do more than verifying local content. We're going to be looking at all sorts of, you know, other issues about who the shareholders are, about, you know, who got the tender. So there is that reluctance to engage because some entities see the process as being intrusive, and you know, that aspect of transparency, and even if we sign and we do sign an NDA, we are a public instrument, we swear by our ability to ensure that our processes can be trusted, and that we keep the information confidential. Sometimes we don't even an engagement from National Treasury when they want a verification of some health report. We don't release that without a formal letter that comes from National Treasury that will clarify why they need this information. And those are some of the prescripts that we work under, and we can't just release the information. So when they don't trust the information is safe, and they think that we're trying to deal with issues of corruption, then we struggle to get in and do our work. Sometimes even when there is commitment on the past, when there is commitment, but it's taken us a year to even do any work because of the issues of trying to clarify what is it exactly that's going to come out of this region. I think the issues of applicability are a reality for the small companies, and we've worked with the DCI to try and find a mechanism to either do a sampling, you work on a sample, you work on a statistical sample, or to also find mechanisms to support financially those activities. Generally, we believe, and in the engagement with international companies that come into South Africa, there's a lot of commitment at a very high policy level on local content verification. It's just on the pathway, we really need to do the work. That's when I think the official of the entity then say, we understand and we're going to say to the companies we want local content, but the verification is not important for somebody who's trying to get the service. And give that service to the company so that the company can achieve its objectives. It's just, you know, it's seen as yet another hurdle. And those are some of the challenges that we are working through with the DCI, trying to get to the verification. Chair, that's my short presentation on the borehole routine this activity. Thank you.
That's critical, Dr. Meshla Makulu. Okay. I'm going to ask members to tackle, if any order really, the DPI as a presentation as well as the FAPS presentation. And I'd like us to do several rounds, so let's try and keep it to a maximum of 3 minutes coming in. I do see your hand up first, the Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Kalago, Honourable Yesterhaven, Honourable M. Comby. Do go ahead.
Thank you very much to the presenters. On the DTI's presentation, a couple of questions. Firstly, your slide on pharmaceuticals, is that an example of non-compliance? I wasn't quite sure why you're raising that example, because if you add up those percentages, actually 56% of the tender went to South African companies when the designation is 70%. And when we went to the committee last year to Aspen Pharmaceuticals, they actually raised the point that a significant portion of the OSD tenders went to an Indian company, and that company did not comply with its commitments under the NIPS, even though the tender was far away above the NIPS threshold, several billion rand. I forget the exact figure, but it's available in our oversight report if you need it. So that to me is an example of a failure of the system. So I just want to ask why, you know, in the context in which you raise it there. Then your review of the instruction notes on steel, I understand the arguments, is very difficult to swallow given the fact that that ArcelorMittal has, despite all of the efforts DTI has made to support it in this very difficult time, has announced that it intends to raise prices again. And so that's a very difficult thing to swallow, that we now are going to give them that additional, in effect, price support. And then on the designations, I come back to vehicles, automotives. I still don't know why we don't designate those, and I've never really got a satisfactory answer. Dump trucks, fire engines, ambulances, police vehicles, metro police vehicles, tens of thousands of vehicles get bought by governments, local governments, municipalities, departments, whatever, across the country every year. And it just makes complete sense to me that they buy locally produced vehicles. I don't know why that is not designated. And there's just one complaint I have which knits together both the first and the second presentations, is that, so I actually disagree slightly with the chairperson. I agree that there's a problem, Doctor, that the verification only gets done after the fact. However, I also agree with the position you're in, that it can't very well be done before the fact, because that would take so long to get through every tender, that tenders would take, some tenders already take years to sort out, it would take even longer, and probably be a lot more costly. That's on that point. But on the DTI role in that process, I have been in receipt of some complaints from tenderers who say that they struggle to get answers or responses from the DTI on those exemption certificates. So when there is a legitimate case where something is not available for whatever reason, we need to make sure that the DTI responds quickly, because you don't want to let that tender expire simply because the person is waiting for an exemption letter from the DTI. And that's what has happened in some cases in the past. So I completely support the process, and I think you've designed a very good process, but it has to work really well, and it has to be efficient, and people must get answered in 48 hours or 72 hours at the most. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Kalaku.
Thanks, Chair. Maybe to both the DTI and the SABF, my understanding, this question is based on the fact that you are alluding to the fact that the mandate, which I think is the mandate you are given by the TTR to verify, is not funded. In essence, I think I hear you saying that is not funded, which to me is a first problem when you deal when you have to apply all this discrimination. Secondly, for DTI, you see, my problem has always been on this, the policy of preferential procurement locally. It's a good policy, the act is there,
My problem is, do you get cooperation firstly from national government departments? So that's where my problem is. Secondly, from local government and provinces. Seemingly everybody is doing his own or her own thing in all tiers of government. I think that's where the problem is. I can see that you are trying very hard and well to make sure these are implemented. But what I cannot understand is this problem between DDI and treasure, especially on the issue of free of challenges, which you have put on the water of challenges. Some of the issues which you raise, I can't understand why they can't be resolved between DDI and national treasure. These are national departments. That is where there are problems which I think we it was. That's where you are going to get other state organs not buying in what you are trying to do at the department. So to me, if you can just clarify that, why is there a problem between National Treasury and DTI in implementing this policy, which in essence is geared towards creation of jobs and also towards making sure that our industry is developed also. Lastly, do you get any complaints? You say I was looking at this process, at your process. When maybe it's because of the flight. To me, it seems to be a very long process. Are you not getting complaints from maybe private sector or from those who want to do business with government that is too much red tape? So we have to go in and then, but it's necessary to do it. How long does the process take? And also, you have mentioned that which makes me very worried. You said it's only Gauteng, Jonas Municipality, that cooperated with you when they were putting up to the tender on buses. Others didn't do that. When do we put a lot of penalties in the act to municipalities who do that? And not only to municipalities, this thing of putting penalties. Somebody knows we'll pay it in government, from government coffers. No, we must arrest and then charge officials. Put them to jail. For actually not implementing the government legislation, because this legislation is an act. I think as you chair, we will have made at some stage to have an interface with our colleagues in the treasury. If we were to make some amendments in the PFMA which are as officials, I think we have to do that. Because the image out there is that our ministers, deputy ministers are not doing their work. Whereas, and us legislators, we are not doing our work. Whereas we have done our work, we have gone through policy with you, we have brought policy to us, we have brought legislation to us. All that is done. But the problem is there in implementation. There must be two things that are happening there. Either officials, they take that, they pass the legislation, we'll implement it as we want. And then, department go down. So I think they will have to look into those things. Because to me, as long as there are no penalties which are accompanied by taking to task the officials responsible for that particular implementation of that act, then will be this at all levels.
Thank you. Thank you very much, right, Honourable Esther Haven.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. The first presentation It was said that an equal concentration and regulation still exists in Triple P. I think the industrial policy action plan is a very good thing, and it was brought in to bring about the specific and sustainable and structural changes to the South African economy, and implementing that the whole structure should actually be better off. I do agree that the growth is led more by consumption-driven sectors instead of the productive sectors, so procurement or buying has actually slacked down through that. How does the private sector, how can it be monitored, how they are committed into supporting the local manufacturing drive? And is the tax incentives that are being advertised enough in the appropriate industries? Then on the South African Bureau, on the RDS, it's a concern to see that there's no funding allocation for implementation offices. That's really a concern. And then also, contractors that maybe get the tenders, they use subcontractors again, who doesn't really give a, doesn't really care about so much about the local content. They will maybe get kick-off spares from Big Mac fast food in New Delhi as long as it gets to the right price. So, but everything good, SABS, my mandate is actually gentlemen at the back talk about standards, about General Electric, and certain standards must be met. The standards must all be up to standard for the general public. And then also a certain on labeling, is it specified in the manufacturing process on labeling, for example, the percentage of local content in the product that's delivered?
Thank you, Honourable Esther Hazen, Honourable Nkongi.
No, thank you very much, Mr. President. I have some few questions. You are raising an issue which for me is very, very fundamental, which talks to your work and the capacity that you have. You say there is no funding from the implementation office. I mean, why there is no funding? Whereas we might have agreed that we need this office because of the critical, even from the implementation of product policy. Where can we get this money? What needs to be changed in order for it to be clear, written down, that who is responsible? What? I know the question of chairing in departments, where people are protecting their own chefs and they cannot give other people what they're supposed to do their duty. So how, what can we do as families to deal with that? The second thing is also the issue of being silent for cause for verification. Is it the responsibility of DTI to give that funding for verification, or it should be a dedicated funding from the treasurer? If that is the case, where can we put it as a policy position that this should happen? The third one, I want to emphasize this much, that you cannot force private sector at this point in time to procure locally. So we cannot write it as a law because we can fight with one trade organization. But what are we doing for our own departments of government, especially the state-owned companies that are not following this? Because they are the culprits, they have big tenders. They change the law when they're sitting in their own desk. They don't consult CTI, they don't consult SPS, they just change things as they wish it. And then what issue? Because if we're talking about penalties, we can't jump and put the private sector and put penalties that as we're unable to discipline our own people. You know, so within your instrument that you are developing, is there any instrument that deals with it? Would we take it from the policy position that speaks about incentives and penalties and put it as an instrument that deals with the non-compliance from our own? You can also go with the question. I've been listening to this presentation of 75% preferential procurement, but I only see Transnet, I only see municipalities, I don't see SAE. I don't see others, the big ones. What is happening in terms of the question of the local procurement? There are many. There are many state-owned enterprises. What is happening one by one in terms of this particular issue? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mkongi. You see, we're coming back to because we seem to be at a point where we have designated certain industries. We've got threshold for localization, this is the percentage. But why have we done that if it's not going to be implemented? I mean, what's the point? We may have conducted some fruitless expenditure here at the state. So I'm still not getting a clear understanding. We may have to come back to this. Exactly, where is this principal act in which we find we can do this? Where is the regulatory system? Because it is that framework that enables you to say, hey, you must comply. Why should I comply? Now, if there is such a framework, why isn't there compliance? What on earth are people doing their own self-verification for? What is the point? I mean, I think everyone would agree on that we seemingly have said things that are not worth the paper they've been put on. Now this is very, very serious. We either go the localization route and we set these, you know, what you can call reasonable targets that you know can be filled, which I'm sure you have indicated that, and who is going to pay? You've already indicated here that small companies and co-ops and this sort of thing can't really meet that cost. You've made that clear. So now someone should be saying who should bear the cost. You've also indicated that Treasury and yourselves have a different view on this, and that Treasury would prefer, if this is what it seems to be saying, not to amend this, to leave it grey. As long as we leave it grey, let's take it off the statute book, because it's worth nothing. We need to say this clearly. So now we want from yourselves, both DTI, there is clear explanation as to hard crop. You know, is this a figment of our imagination, designation and verification? What is it? Where are the teeth? Now I want that spelled out now. Please. Thank you.
Thanks, Madam Chair. The colleagues from HAT and the DTI will come in. I mean, my own view is that the committee's put its finger on the problem. The PPPSA is not our act. Neither are the regulations which accompany the PPPSA our act. It's the National Treasury's Act. And I put Honourable Member Kalako put his finger on the problem with yourself, Madam Chair. You know, actually, if you look at all the policy instruments, it's designated as the Competitive Supplier Development Program, which falls under DPE. It's the NIP, which falls under the DTI. It's the Renewable Energy Independent Power Producers, which falls under the DOE. The CSDP falls under the DPE. As we speak, the Mining Charter has got no requirements for localization. Falls under the Department of Mineral Resources. Mining companies have been importing equipment and winning the contract on the basis of BEE, which very often is fronting, and the mining supply companies, which used to be globally competitive in South Africa, are now surviving on exports. They're not sharing contracts from South African mines. So, Madam Chair, it's very difficult as an official to sit here, and the Deputy Minister is here, to say anything other than the fact that the committee has put its finger on the problem, which is the requirement for strengthening of the procurement legislation, which doesn't fall under the DTI, securing the right sanction across government departments, SOEs, and spheres of government for non-compliance, and that's an very important piece of work that has to happen, because frankly speaking, we fight a rear guard action as the National Treasury all the time with limited policy instruments at our disposal to secure localization and its twin sister, black economic empowerment in the manufacturing space. And so I can only say that I think the committee would assist if the National Treasury, the SOCs, economic development, which by the way, to answer Honourable Corky's question, private sector procurement, we cannot under the WTO insist on localization. But the private sector 4 years ago signed a procurement accord with EDD to commit to localization. If your big health institutions or big construction companies and so on and so forth committed to localization, it would make an enormous difference to the manufacturing sector. Our view is, in fact, there's been very little, notwithstanding the signature on the procurement accord, there's been very little private sector commitment to local procurement and supplier development. Secondly, Madam Chair, the nature of the contradiction with respect to verification is as follows. If verification becomes a regulatory and cost barrier to the private sector, in my opinion, it becomes a very big problem. On the other hand, you, as the CEO, Bonnie Mekomapula, has said, is if there is no verification and instruments to secure compliance, it can become open to abuse. My own personal view is that you need a combination of, and we've looked at other countries, declaration with spot testing. So if you are found to be falsely declaring, you're punished. In Thailand, where we went to, to look at auto issues, and this was a project which was sponsored, so it wasn't on the government's balance sheet, we asked my equivalent in the Thai Department of Trade and Industry, how do you do this? And he said, it's a declaration. If we come and test you and you've lied on the form, you go to jail. Full stop. So there's no, we don't have a compliance instrument that we can use at our disposal. Then, so Madam Chair, I'm saying we don't have the necessary instruments, but we've got to make sure that the instrument is supportive of industrialization and doesn't become such an enormous cost and regulatory barrier that it has an unintended consequence that companies feel that, you know, that it's too much of a barrier for them to be applying. Madam Chair, with respect to pharmaceuticals, please bear in mind that we designate, that having reached agreement with the National Treasury, we are unable to designate pharmaceuticals as a sector. Bear in mind that we designate sectors, so clothing, textile, leather, and footwear. No government department or agency can procure from anywhere else except South Africa. But In certain other instances, we are either not able to designate the whole sector, or as a threshold, or we designate in combination with the National Treasury, tender by tender. And in health, there's a particular problem, because the Minister of Health has said the security of supply issues in health are absolutely critical. We couldn't end up in a situation where, because company X in South Africa has not been able to supply on time the required quantities to the right specifications, and hospitals suddenly sit without ARVs, then there's a big, very big problem. And so we are particularly cautious in relation to health. That we can't create a national health crisis where we use an industrial development instrument. I think to follow up on the Honourable Hill Lewis's question, I think we, maybe Dr. McCooper will come in, but we need to just ensure with working in this instance, not only with the National Treasury, also the Department of Health, to just, you know, answer the question in a bit more detail.
Let me interrupt you here, DDG, because I only looked up now and saw the Deputy Minister, so, and I believe you've been there here for some time, Deputy Minister Sina. You're very welcome, thank you. And you can see that this is a very pertinent point, which will affect programs such as the Black Industrialist, the Triple BW, and others. Thank you very much. Do continue, DDG.
The private sector, the key issue is the procurement record, and it's obviously in your jurisdiction, but as far as we were are concerned, we'd be very happy to see EDD, you know, report on the extent to which the private sector come to the table in relation to their commitments of the procurement record. Then, Honourable Member Ilse raised the issue of traceability. And of course, verification is a very complex problem. One of the ministers said that the formula that we have at the moment for verification, you could drive a bus through. But the problem is that if you put the formula as so complicated, you can then also build in a regulatory barrier, which it becomes part of the red tape that the Honourable colleagues spoke about. So it's this balance between the right policy instruments to secure compliance, declaration, verification with traceability, and my own personal view is that in big fleet procurement, verification should be compulsory. In other words, there's no room for declaration. There has to be verification. But the traceability issues are hugely important. So we're working with the clothing and textile cluster to develop, amongst other things, an electronic system to allow traceability. So in the suit that I wear, it's said to be locally produced, but whether the buttons and the textiles come from and how is the traceability the subject of a proper verification? As far as I know, there's no labelling requirement in the Consumer Protection Act for localisation, but it's something that perhaps should be considered. With respect to funding, Madam Chair, my view is that there has to be a combination of, as I said, declaration, verification, and compliance, including the Auditor General. My own view is that the costs should be shared between the public and the private sector in circumstances where there is enormous fiscal constraint to be requesting considerable transfer to the SAD from the fiscus, I suspect, is unlikely. With respect to steel, Honourable Hill Lewis, please bear in mind the following. There is, as we speak, you know, I'm speaking as an official here. There is no, as yet, agreement between the government and the primary steel producers and the downstream steel intensive value adding manufacturers. A package of measures still has to be agreed to, which would include an agreement on pricing with the primary steel producers, of which one is the overwhelming big player in the market, linked to tariffs, linked to removing the deeming of steel, linked to support measures for the downstream. In other words, if we only put in place tariff protection for the upstream and they pass on price increases to the downstream, we will hit those labor intensive sectors. But because the processes of ITAC can take up to a year, as stipulated in the World Trade Organization commitments that we have, ITAC has, with the minister's signature, agreed to 10% increases for 3 steel products with another 8 in the pipeline, with the stipulation that the price increases cannot be as a direct result of the tariff increases. Bear in mind, of course, that there are other reasons why the primary steel producer would have to increase its steel price. For example, the blast furnaces at Thunder Bay use coking coal. They don't use coal from South Africa. And so the cost of importing coking coal in circumstances where the value of the rand plummeted has meant that the input cost, the production cost of ArcelorMittal, have increased. And therefore they argue that their prices have had to increase, not simply because of the tariff space that's been provided. So government, and I'm not at liberty, the ministers are at liberty, or have the prerogative to make the statement, which I understand will be made in due course, with respect to the final agreement on the pricing mechanism and its compliance instruments. So there is no agreement at the moment. There are a set of very difficult and complex engagements with upstream and downstream to try and arrive at a solution. And then, with respect to the vehicles, and you know, yeah, you get into difficult terrain. I think the designation of yellow metals, which is essentially the equipment which municipalities use, Dr. Makule will correct me, I think it's been with the National Treasury for maybe 9 months, and so we can designate another 50 products, but the point made by Honourable Member Kalako is critical. You need policy coherence with National Treasury, with public enterprises, and with the state and companies, so that we don't want to run ahead with lots of designations until such time as there's policy coherence and operational compliance in relation to these issues. You know, we said this before, the richest Bay municipality in which our equipment is located, where, and they've got a supply chain supporting 4,000 jobs, up until recently was importing front-end loaders and other equipment from abroad, but the company that makes that equipment is in that municipality. Fortunately, they've changed their position and they're now procuring from a local manufacturer. The last thing, Madam Chair, is I think we have to see procurement as one of the policy levers, unless it's supported by other policy levers as well.
full example, and that equipment would be a good example. We designate for local procurement because we're raising aggregate demand from the domestic market. But our domestic market is actually small. So how do you bring other policy levers to support a company like that, I'm using that as an example, to get into export markets? And so absolutely critical here is to raise the competitiveness of this company, including in respect of technology, where there's a danger that South African companies are falling behind. But then you have to support them within the framework of what is allowed by the WTO, because we can't subsidize exports, so that having raised aggregate domestic demand, these companies then reach export readiness and are supported, especially with export credit insurance, where our export credit instrument is very poor. We are being blown out of the water, including in relation to export into Africa, because our export credit offering, as another instrument that we deploy in tandem with the procurement instrument, frankly speaking, isn't good enough. Thank you.
Thank you very much, DG. I am going to ask the CEO to come in, or Dr. Makube, but at the end, Minister, I hope that you would also be able to make a broad comment at the end and add to this. So would it be yourself, Dr. Makube?
Yes, sir. Thanks. Let me clarify a few things there. Around the verification. Well, the process and the payment part. By law, bidders are required to fill in standard bidding documents, as well as the annexures declaring their local content. So, in the annexures, we have three of them. There is annexure fee, which deals with the local content. It's a compulsory returnable document. So if that is not attached to the bidding document, the tender is not supposed to be considered. So if there is an import content, there will be an annexure fee that deals with the import content. Bidders must fill in that, as well as E, which deals with the local cost of manufacture. Annexure E and E are not compatible. Returnable documents. Bidders must remain with those documents. So in essence, we have two documents which are compulsory. Bidding documents as well as annexure. Now we use those to assess whether bidders are complying or not. And we send those documents to the SAPS for verification. So verification is a post-award verification, after the tender has been awarded. And the SAPS will have to use the document to do the verification. Now, bidders are not compelled to pay qualification before the tender has been awarded. So you can imagine we have about thousands of them bidding. And others have complained that if you require them to pay for verification before a tender is awarded, you know, there is no risk. So there is no guarantee that they will win. But I know instances where some OEMs have went to the SAPS to say that please verify us before upfront. You know. So we need the challenge here around the payment is who pays after the tender has been awarded. Now bidders are saying, no, we didn't cost for verification in our bidding document. So therefore, you cannot come afterwards and say, hey. So the issue here is, who pays? Is it the state? And in the state, is it the procuring department? Or do we make an appropriation for verification? But also remember that this is a behavioral issue. We are also dealing with people who can afford to pay, and they will take advantage of the provision that the state will pay for verification. So we need to review. Our view is that yes, there are some bidders who cannot genuinely afford to pay, you know. So you need to exempt them, but do the verification. So somebody must bear the cost of doing that verification, because you must be seen to be taking local production series. So there have been some engagements with the National Treasury to say please amend the standard bidding document so that you make provision for the cost of verification. Then there are debates around the price premium on performance, which we haven't been able to resolve. So I think moving forward we still have to clarify the issue of who pays for verification. Then the issue on pharmaceutical tenders that the DGG has alleged. Let me clarify that we don't have the minimum threshold for local production in the pharmaceutical tender. So there are many issues there. I mean, the issue of intellectual property rights, the issue of active pharmaceutical ingredients, security of supply. So we've decided to deal with the pharmaceutical sector tender by tender. So that is why we don't have a minimum threshold. So the 70% that the member was alluding to is that the oral solid dosage tender that was outed initially in 2014, the 70% of the volume was given to local companies. But 70% is not the minimum threshold for local production there. So there's no minimum threshold. We deal with it per tender. The exemption letters, we have committed ourselves that we will respond to people who are requesting for an exemption. We take about 48 hours to respond to them, to acknowledge receipt. So it is possible that, you know, people don't read the instruction note properly, because my name appears in all the instruction notes. So if they send the request to T. Makude at the DTI, I will respond. Even now, also, I'm responding to some of working to people to respond. So within 48 hours, we do respond. But it is possible that they send the request to a different email address at the DTI and will miss that. We do have a also standard email address, which is local contact at the DTI. So if they also send that, we'll be able to pick that. So and if there's evidence that people have requested an exemption and the DTI didn't respond, I'll be able to, you know, come and explain how it was. If it was sent to local content at the DTI or to my address, then I'll be able to explain why we did it. So remember that it's 48 hours to acknowledge receipt, but we also have to consult with the industry, because sometimes the request is based on the number of volumes that are required. So we have to consult with the industry that they are able to submit or produce and deliver the required volumes at a time. And if that is not possible, we would then grant the exemption. And lastly, Madam Chair, it's around the 75% local procurement. As the DTR, in terms of the procurement legislation general, I can say that we are responsible for the local content policy as well as the BBBE policy. So anything outside that is the National Treasury. Now the challenge with the 75% local procurement is that with local content is very clear. BDAP must indicate the threshold for local production. So that is a success. They must pass that hurdle, whether they 100% or less. So as I said, we use the bidding document as the annexure for evaluation. Now anything outside local content will be evaluated on the basis of the price and the BBBE. Now it creates a challenge for 75%, because if it is not designated, it will be evaluated like in other tenders. So that is why we're saying we need a framework
as well as the instruments to support the designated persons outside designation. We have taken an initiative to come up with guidelines based on 9.3 because we believe it is a very important instrument to support the local procurement of non-designated persons. So we are working with the National Treasurer on that. But remember that it only talks about local manufacturing. So any other service that is procured and has nothing to do with local manufacturing, we need a different instrument to reach the 75% local procurement target as envisaged by the government.
Thank you, Dr. Makube. Dr. Meshla Makulu.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I'll address a few questions that were posed directly to the NABF. The first question about the funding of the mandate. I will be honest on this point and say when we started with the DTI on this journey, it was always meant to be a self-funding mandate. That objective then falls flat when there isn't enforcement. And so if we deal with the issue of enforcement, we will not need to put a strain on the fiscal. We could even subsidize the small companies and the cooperatives from the revenue that will come from the big company. The model of pricing could accommodate for this. So the requirement for enforcement has always been there to make the model to work. When the enforcement doesn't happen, then you find yourself in a situation where you need to ask who then has to pay the bill. So we're getting in this situation because enforcement is not happening. Now, tell me this to clarify that because we were not given an unfunded mandate by the DTI and then we let it. It was always designed to be a self-funding mandate with the enforcement. And when the enforcement then doesn't happen, we find ourselves in that situation. I also need to get to the issue of whether the verification of local content goes with the standard mandate. The mandate is intertwined. The legislation talks about conformity of products and services to standard specification. And this is a specification that deals with issues of local content. But when you separate the two, you would find that you have conformity to localization, but you don't have conformity to quality. And the companies will still not take the products into their value chains because they don't conform to their standards. So you need to bring this together to ensure that you bring the competitiveness. One of those of the regulators has approached us, that's the rail station regulator, where they are dealing with issues of now approving the products that have come into the transfer procurement process. There's local content that is stipulated, but there is no quality assurance. And they are struggling to then approve these products into their system because we focus on local content and not on the quality. And when you don't bring this together, you are then compromising the ability of the company to sustainably get into the supply chain of the OEM. And we need to have the two together in order for us to be able to ensure that the local company continues to be competitive, or the companies that are developed with the right competitive systems of good quality assurance and the local content systems. The process that we've outlined here runs in parallel with the normal procurement process, so it does not interfere with the timeline. It's not meant to interfere with the timeline. It happens behind the scenes. So when the entity prescribes in their spec the local content threshold, they go through the normal process. They issue a tender and the work gets started, and that's when we then come in with the DTI to start the process. the only issue there is that a month down the line, when you've done the verification, you may go back to the entity and say, this company, self-declaration, was exaggerated, it does not comply. And then the entity or the government department will then need to withdraw the tender. And so what we give as an assurance is that their process, the post-verification, will take, depending on the scope and the size of the tender, will take 2 weeks to 2 months. But that's known by the company that they start this process. That if you have exaggerated your local content so that you get through this gate and through this procurement process, and you win the tender, and we find that in our investigation you don't decide, you will lose the tender. But I think the punishment should be harsher than that, because somebody, there's an opportunity cost, the time wasted, there are all sorts of implications for the state when a tender has been awarded and work has started, and then you have to stop the work and restart the process or issue the tender to the next bidder. And that bidder has to go through the same verification process. So there are those implications, and that's why the fourth declaration should be dealt with more stricter than just withdrawing the tender. And there must be a sanction that will deter people from exaggerating their local content of declaration. Chair, those are the issues that I highlighted on my slide. I don't know if I've missed anything.
Well, we'll soon see from members, but thank you very much. I just would like the Deputy Minister Messina, to have the opportunity to comment.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. I think the officials have really attempted to respond to some of the questions from the honourable members. I think my view is that some of the industrial policy instruments have been taken away from DTI, making it almost impossible or very difficult to ensure cross coordination, as I think you are hearing that this is one of the issues here. Things like Competition Commission, ITEC, maybe even IDC and so on, are important instruments for us to be doing the kind of work we're doing to support manufacturing. But those, as you know, are somewhere else now. The second thing, I think, the cost associated with this, I think we've got to find a way, because just listening to the CEO of SADF, it's very clear that if we don't find a mechanism to be even much more clearer, even at whatever point, that cost associated with verification should be borne by the bidder who has won the tender. I think we've got to find a way of strengthening that part, because it would appear that it's not, once people have won the tender, they turn around and say, no, well, why not I pay, and so on. I think we've got to find a mechanism to be upfront. If those forms that you are talking about, form, we said this form C or something of the tender, if it's not clear, maybe that's one of the things that we'll have to look at and correct. I think that we'll have to get a proper advice so that we don't overstep our own authority as well as government. And the issue of having capacity at the SADS for verification and strengthening the enforcement, I think is another issue that must be looked at. What is the role of the SOEs or the government departments that are issuing the tenders? Can they be harsh enough to say, look, if you are found to have transgressed, we withdraw the tender? What is the implication on service delivery? And I think these are issues that we need to look at in order to balance. And it is true that I think the issue of policy coordination broadly at the level of government, in particular with National Treasury, is very critical. And one of the issues that we've been saying that we've got to find each other in order to ensure that we're able to make progress in this area. And maybe now that we've got a number of products that have been designated, we must go back to industry players, those that are targeting, and just have roadshows about the rules of the game, because others might want to plead ignorance in the process of all this. Maybe we might need to do just that
you know, one day session where we're saying, look, these are the issues, this is what is expected, and get all the raw data from DTI, from SARS, from National Treasury, and all the procurement offices. Just explain the importance of this, because I think the fact that people can ignore such an important government policy is a shame taken on our side. And I think it's one of the major campaigns that we might need to pick up this year to ensure that we raise the profile of this work. And I really think that's the answer to some of the questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Deputy Minister. You know, as we come towards the conclusion here, I don't think members of the committee fully realise all the loopholes in this area. This was seen as a very sharp instrument for radical transformation with respect to localization and the Industrial Policy Action Programme and Plan. And in the, what we've heard here is it's more or less your choice. And it comes with a nice bid, competitive bid to someone, to an SOE, to a local municipality, and it'll be up to you. You'll be given the bid anyway. There's nothing there that says you must also produce your verification, is there? Given that a lot of the municipalities are not doing that. So there's nothing to make them comply. And this came to my attention over certain electricity meters. I don't mean the smart, but the others that were simply being purchased, imported, when we were producing them here by a municipality, in fact, 20 municipality, and it was all to do with, well, they were cheaper. Are we not prepared to pay a premium? This is the whole issue for localization within an acceptable limit, while encouraging companies to be more competitive. You know, the point here is the self-verification. We do need the department and SAB to look at a more stringent means. Is it going to be a regular random check that you don't have the funds now to put in a full inspection and insist, but you can go and do that? Is that what you can do with what you've got right now? But the point I'm hearing is, well, even if you find that it doesn't comply, what's the penalty? There doesn't appear to be one. At least I never heard one. And it's the old story. You don't want to, you know, collapse companies, industries. You don't. That's the unintended consequence. At the same time, don't you want to encourage it? But where is this balance? Do you just allow people to take and make the choices? And I think this is a serious issue. It really is across the board. So I was looking at some of the 100%ers here. We leave the pharmaceuticals out, but there's school furniture. Is all of that being purchased locally? There's electrical and telecommunication cables, 90%. Now these are very high percentages. Textiles. I don't know what we mean by textiles. Does that include women's clothing? Because it says 100% here. But you've only got to take tripping any more to see that that's not being complied with. So what is this for? Is this for show or do we mean it? And I think the committee has to make some input here as a committee. You know, is this just a cosmetic game? What is it? Let's hear from you guys. Thank you. Arnold Hill Lewis?
Just to say, I think about the 100% designation for women's clothing refers to government procurement, so it can't be in shopping malls and that kind of thing. But let me just get back to the follow-up point. I 100% agree with Mr. Strachan on export competitiveness, and I also 100% agree on the point about policy coordination. And I'd like to ask Chair that we simply, as committee, write to the Treasury and ask for an answer as to why the yellow metal has taken 9 months without being confirmed and designated. And I think that's something simple that we can do to try and achieve that kind of coordination. so if we could write that letter, I think that would be helpful. Then, Dr. Lekemakulu, thank you very much. I completely understand your position and sympathize with it greatly. But I also understand why companies wouldn't want to volunteer to come and be verified when the consequences of that might be that they lose the tender. It's kind of like asking, you know, turkeys to vote for Christmas. It's just not going to happen. So there's no real built-in incentive. It's more like, and because there's no penalty for them not doing it, more of them are not going to do it than are going to do it. So we do need to have a rethink there. Once again, I understand why we can't ask them to do it beforehand, because you might have 10 companies tendering and only one is going to win. So the other 9 are going to have wasted money on verification. They can't do that. But also, the post-ipso facto verification needs to be somehow, we need to think of a way to better design it. And I would argue, actually, this is just off the top of my head, we'll think through the consequences properly, but if it's a big tender, hundreds of millions of rands, there's no reason why the state actually shouldn't invest in verifying that and paying for that themselves. It becomes difficult for smaller tenders, I understand, because that will become very expensive and unaffordable. So we do need to rethink that. But there's an obvious conflict of interest there. Companies are not going to volunteer to do something the consequences of which might lose in the tender. And if they do it, it's because they're so sure of their local content that they're happy to have it verified. But those which say claim to have 85% local content when in fact it's 75%, they're not 100% sure it's what they claim. They're not going to go have that verified voluntarily. So there is definitely a problem there. Thank you. Oh, sorry. Doctor, just on the letters, I understand that I told you for acknowledging receipts within 48 hours, but how long does it take you to get the letters out, a letter of exemption?
Thank you, Jen. I also actually wanted to say that it should be made more attractive for companies, that some incentives built in. I'll just say something actually that I personally feel. I think our people have got very few resources, the poor people, they're very few resources. The only thing they actually got to sell is their own labour. So I think if, say in a rural area, in KwaZulu-Natal, for example, they grew nuts, they should be able to add value to it. They should be able to pack it or bottle it or whatever before they can sell it or before it's procured by big companies.
Thank you, Honourable Esterhazy, Honourable Mkongi.
So thank you, Mr. President. I'm just interested, how long does it take to complete the verification? How long is it? Does it depend on the size and scope of the tender? I mean, or is it one day? Well, you just spoke about four. Even you have to do it now. I'm saying you spoke about four. Three forms or two forms that you can just fill them now quickly and then you submit to finish the decision. So how long does it take to do that? And also I was going to encourage that to look at, let's say, different options in terms of the verification cost of funding. Maybe on the size of the tender, on the thickness, and so forth. Because I'm also worried about this small client. Will the majority become spec? You know, you can. So maybe you look at many types that we can do, and then you make proposals that if we're saying that the state must take responsibility, which department must take responsibility? You know, whether it should be part and parcel of the Treasury regulations to regulate the question of verification in order for us as members of Parliament to make some proposals. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mkongi. I just want to come back to the point again that this is a policy instrument. That is the first thing. If it is a policy instrument, then this government is obliged to implement that policy instrument rigorously. And we understand the limitation in terms of WTO that about only governments or state-owned entities, state-owned companies that can be forced to comply. But the fact remains there are municipalities. Are these being run by private people now? Or are they governments? See? And we all know what's going on there, number one. We know what's going on in provincial departments across the board. And I'm looking at who, you know, in the electrical and communication cable, a municipality, and as I was reading through your documents here, you're not allowed to subcontract once you've got this, because you don't want to dilute that. So, the electrical and telecommunication cables, are you saying then that the municipality is obliged to only, because we've only got private entities in this field, manufacturing, so that is why they all must comply? What is the problem? Don't we have other people producing electrical and telecommunication cables? You see, we're coming back to this. What is the point of putting 100% of all our fuel desks locally procured? I really don't know. I haven't looked at it. And some of the issues here on 90 and 80, etc., the buses, the municipal buses, which municipalities are not complying, you see. And I do disagree with some members here, but we can't just go forward on the chair's position, but let me make myself clear to members so they're aware of the position I'm coming from. If you've got this, and you say, look, you can all bid for this, and I'm going to accept the bid as a municipality, and one of the criteria will be price, one of it. Not all of it. Competence of several things. Are you competent? Can you, have you got the experience to complete this program and project? I'll take all of that into account. Now, just supposing I want to make sure I get that. Quite frankly, I know that I don't have to prove local verification. I just don't have to. That's a fact. Because if I win, that's it. And I think at the very least, surely we can say to those coming in that if you apply and you state, and I'm talking about a huge differential, not 10%. I think 10% is a little fine, you know, with this kind of thing. But if I say I've got 80% or 70, in fact I've got 50, I think you should be penalized. You see, you hear you at least agree with that, I think, position. And that's what we need to come in here. We want to stop. Don't bid if that is your position. We don't want you bidding. Get your house in order. And maybe go into some joint enterprise with another local entity. But we would like, certainly we are going to send a letter back to you indicating that we remain concerned, but at the same time we realize we want this balance. We must have a coordination between departments, especially in the state national fishery with ourselves. And we're looking at two major pieces of legislation here. And all we don't pass legislation on the understanding that we're not going to implement. That is not why we pass it. So we would like you yourselves to come up with a proposal to tell us how do you think we can tighten this up. What is there that we can tighten up? There must be something. So, we've got a tight schedule, but we would appreciate it if within a week or two, before we arrive, please can you come up with this and let us know. And I'm sure it has a bearing on the Black Industrialist Program as well, you know, Deputy Minister. And if this is our attitude to legislation, why are we even having the Black Industrialist? We're also going to say, well, we can't do it. We must start saying we can and do the best we can. But I do want to thank the DTI, I want to thank Sam, and in particular Deputy Minister, you know, we want to thank you. I know your schedule doesn't often allow you to be here with us, but thank you very much for coming in this morning. And members, I want to thank you for being here on time. It has enabled us to finish much earlier, notwithstanding that Treasury was going to be here, but is unable due to the appropriation bill. Yes, Honourable Hill Lewis?
sorry, Chair, just two brief matters. I just asked for an answer on how long the department takes to get those letters of exemption out from when they receive those emails. And then does the committee agree that we write a note to Treasury on the yellow medals?
We do want to do that. Maybe we should try and get you to send this information in within a week. I'm just looking at our program, because if you do that, we could look this again next Wednesday. You see, I'm sure that's not too difficult. I'm looking at the key players here. Next Wednesday, we're saying try and get us a position, or you want until the 15th on Tuesday in life.
Madam Chair, we can certainly give you a position, which would be the DTI position. I mean, my own personal view, if you don't mind me saying this, is that the position of the other government departments also needs to be part of the package of issues that the committee examines, because we've for a long time said we need a much better legislative policy instrument to secure this. By the way, we're not allowed, Madam Chair, to designate services under trips and trims. So government procurement targets of 75%. Taking that, you're going to only procure outside of services. Actually, it's probably nearer 85% for manufacturing if you're excluding services. So in circumstances where you have a blunt instrument, to be polite about it, you're never going to achieve that unless you increase the policy coherence, program coordination and implementation with stronger instruments. We can give you our proposals. I'm so sure Dr. Makube could do that within a week.
Well, look, we hope we would get as much back as possible. We're going to be rising on the 22nd of March. What one would have liked to have done in this regard is to say, this is where we are. We've written these various letters. We've had responses back to this. And how can we, here as the PC in Parliament, Portfolio Committee of Trade and Industry, what can we put in place to get stakeholders here? Now, we can look, and I'm also saying this, and the Deputy Minister would also take that into account as well. We could look at a situation when we come back to put in process a colloquium that brings in these various government stakeholders, which we only really kick off with in September. Do you follow? So we start the process, as it were, because until you get every municipality, every government department, sphere, and so on participating, you're not going to succeed. You know, would we all agree on that basis? So we say, not going to be done top shop, let's get this back, let's plan it, and begin to kick it off in September after local government elections sometime. Can we move on that basis? But you will get a correspondence back. And I just want to indicate, Friday, as you know, Parliament has changed the programme quite a lot. And that means there is no Thursday sitting, I believe. And there is no Friday. We're going to take Friday right off. It would appear as if all parties are looking to ensure with the RDC that we really have a good turnout for the registration process. And as South Africans, we should all participate, especially members of Parliament. Yes, I'm saying it's the fourth, it's the fifth and the sixth, but what we're saying is the focus would be on that. So with the committee work, we are saying we're leaving Friday. We're not coming here Friday. Alright? That's clear then? Fine. Thank you, Honourable Hilden.
Yeah, no, I really like the idea of a colloquium, Chair. I wonder if the department in their written response would provide us with a list of the countries or the biggest state procurers. Let's say the top 10, top 20. I presume it will be Eskom, Transnet, Public Works, Defence Force, whatever. But maybe you can just, that's just a guess. If you could give us a list of the top 20 biggest procurers, then we can invite them to the colloquium as well. Thank you.
Honourable Whip, is there anything, Honourable Kalaka, you wish to raise this is being on for Tuesday. We'll be meeting again next Tuesday, and that will be the 8th, the annual, the strategic and annual performance plan of DTI. What will be added is the oversight report. The box, you will be getting it, by the way, tomorrow, I believe, or Friday, electronically. So we'll have that. And then we're doing DTI's third quarter as well, and consideration of minutes. So we don't expect an early date on Tuesday. All right. So on that note, thank you to the committee, and I hope we can all put in a lot of legwork on the Saturday and Sunday. And thank you very much to the minister, the department, and SAD. Thank you.
Thank you.
I've tried to do that.
Okay.
Yes, it is.